Welcome back to part two of Broad Appeal, Kate Blanchett, Good, Bad, Crazy Edition. I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian.
Great. Brian, what's our next film?
Our next film, Sean, is Veronica Guerin, and I'm going to say it right now. I will do my best to not use a cod Irish accent.
Thank you.
You are wearing a green shirt at the moment, so it's highly triggering.
Well, you're also half Irish. That's highly triggering.
Somewhere within about a minute or two of this film beginning, Kate Blanchett spoke for the first time as Veronica Guerin. I turned to you, worried, and you made a gesture.
I did the pointing finger meeting the thumb in a circle and kind of pulsating it forward a few times.
If you have a hard time envisioning that, listeners, I imagined that to mean spot on.
It's a waste of time what I'm writing. I'm a reporter. I'm supposed to be writing about things that matter. I have a great life. I have a great family. But I feel like I should be making a difference.
So I want to just correct my opinion of her accent a little bit from yesterday.
Let it be known, when the film was going on, you seemed to think it was perfect.
No, it's very good. It's very, very good. It's just not particularly Dublin, exactly. It's kind of all over Ireland, but not Northern Ireland. Which actually is a very difficult thing for actors to do, is to keep it from going north of the border.
I have learned a bit more about the Irish accent since cohabitating with you, being your partner in podcasting and life. But I will say that as an American, you know, so often when non-American actors do an accent, I feel like they fall into one of two pitfalls. So one is doing such a generic American accent that it's just like this nasal thing that doesn't sound like it's from anywhere.
Okay.
And the other is like so minutely studying that it's from like Baltimore or Chicago or Boston that they just sound like a lunatic. So maybe actually Kate did something that's very hard to do, which is to accurately do a passable generic Irish accent without going down the road of specifically Dublin. Because do we know, like, maybe Veronica Guerin wasn't originally from Dublin?
No, she was from Artane, which is in Dublin.
Okay, well, I guess we do know. So, well, this leads me to the...
Will we ever know where she's from?
This leads me to another question, which is, when I heard the name Veronica Guerin, I think Kate Blanchett, because the only thing I know about Veronica Guerin is this film. But when you and I, a few years ago, took our first trip together to Dublin...
First and only.
Yes. We spent quite a bit of time together, but there was one point where you're like, Brian, I've had enough of you. Just so I went off wandering around myself, around Dublin Castle, went in and saw some art, and I was in a...
Enjoyed a piece of soda bread... nurtured a potato to full growth.
I followed a rainbow to the end and saw Darby O'Gill.
Like all Americans, you have to have some fabulistic story of Ireland.
To be honest, what I probably was doing was following in the steps of Leopold Bloom and being like, ah, here's where the Circe chapter took place.
Oh, God. You know, most Irish people think Bloom is a bit highfalutin. Well, give us Maeve Binchy any day of the week.
Darling, highfalutin is my middle name. But anyway, as I was wandering around Dublin Castle, what did I come across but a bronze bust of a woman with a kind of...
Princess Diana haircut.
Princess Diana haircut. And I thought, this is a bit odd and out of place, until I read the plaque and discovered this was indeed Veronica Guerin. I was like, oh my god, it's Kate Blanchett. That was sacrilege, because
yes.
Apparently
yes,
she
was.
Is a well-known sort of martyr to... Investigative journalism.
Investigative journalism, and I think we can't make any light-heartedness.
I'm not trying to.
No, I know you're not, but it's. I think we live in a particular time where the role of the journalist is under threat in terms of the good that they do, and the journalists that people seem to trust are these cronies for, you know, the Trump swamp that they all seem to swim in. Fox News, horrible people. They're supposedly journalists as well. But they're not crooked journalists.
Just going to say, Jody Cantor, Maggie Haberman.
Yeah.
They're out there.
We love them.
Winners of the Pulitzer Prize, only this week, along with Kendrick Lamar.
Yeah.
So, Veronica Guerin, is this a case of an American-directed movie, like, over-promoting someone? Or is this actually a case of a household name that every Irish person...
Oh, household name. Absolute household name. Like, even when I was a kid, I just knew her name. I didn't know what she was. I didn't know about the Dublin gangland killings. Actually, not to jump to the end, but there's mention of the Criminal Assets Bureau, which was created in the wake of her death. I remember hearing about the Criminal Assets Bureau all the time on the radio and news reports, but it never occurred to me that it was something that had just been created. So, thanks to her, we have the Criminal Assets Bureau.
Also, in those same rolling title cards that come at the end, the film makes the bold assertion that every Irish person remembers where they were when they learned the news of Veronica Guerin's death. I turned to you and I said, do you remember, Sean?
Well, I was a child, Brian. I was about 7 years old, so...
I remember where I was when the Challenger space shuttle
exploded. Yeah, because you were watching it, darling.
Okay. So where were you?
You've done some research. I will tell you at the end of the podcast.
No, tell us now.
No, it'll be... This is the end of the podcast.
Ooh, this will entice listeners to stay on to the end.
Or just skip to the end right now.
Well, speaking of ends... I mean, this movie begins with one tone that's quite light, right? We're in a church, and we zero in on a priest. It's a traditional, you know, vision of Irish Catholicism. And it's even more traditional in another way. There's a certain character actress that we hadn't done our research, didn't know she was going to pop up, but there she was, the first... speaking character in the film playing Veronica's mother. It was
Academy Award winner Brenda Fricker.
More about Brenda and her minimal dialogue in a moment, but she does have one line in the first scene where she says, "Father, I need you to pray for my daughter. Please pray that she will not keep her driving license." We're introduced to Veronica as this devil-may-care young woman who frequently speeds, has been brought before a small court because of her speeding tickets, and she's comically trying to get herself out of a little scrape.
A small court. I'm sorry, just because it's not in America doesn't mean our courts are any smaller than yours.
I guess what I meant was...
It would be the district court.
Brought up on small claims, small charges, not anything serious, right? She's before the court. She effectively worms her way out of having to have her license revoked. Then she's quickly back in her hot red roadster, speaking into her 1996 car phone, and we're thinking... Okay, I know this movie is going to be a serious look at the drug culture of gangland Dublin, but actually, we're introduced to this woman in a very comic way, which abruptly ends.
She pulls up to a traffic light. Next to her is a black motorbike with two guys on it. They smash into her window, and that is where the film begins.
Well, they do more than smash
her. They kill her, yeah.
They shoot her to death.
Well, they don't shoot her to death at the very start of it. We just see her window being smashed.
Yeah, but basically, I guess if you know the story of Veronica Guerin, you know that this is the end of Veronica Guerin. Yeah. And then we're told, here's the film, Veronica Guerin, produced by Jerry Bruckheimer and directed by Joel Schumacher.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird things going on in this film. I do think it's very interesting that they had the nerve to show our lead heroine's death at the very start of the film. It's just not something you do. And I'm guessing, I don't know how this film was marketed. I know it didn't recoup its budget. I'm sure it did quite well in Ireland, actually.
Well, it's funny, though, isn't it? Because I only knew of this version of the Veronica Guerin story. But as with so many things, one movie is greenlit and is being made, and then there's, another movie that, is coming along the pike at the same time. So you had sort of two Truman Capote movies, two Robin Hood movies developing at the same time. And you were saying to me that there's actually another Veronica Guerin movie?
Yeah, so a few years before that, there was a film called When the Sky Falls, which... actually isn't about Veronica Guerin, it's about
Adele.
It's Adele. No jokes, Brian, this is very serious.
Okay, sorry.
Okay, it's about a fictionalized version of her, but it is essentially the same story.
And who stars in that?
Well, Joan Allen, apparently, thanks to Wikipedia.
Yeah, it's Joan Allen.
AKA Pat Nixon.
Yeah, and also Goody Proctor.
Yeah.
And The Contender. Another American actress playing this martyred investigative Irish journalist.
Well, Kate's not another She's Australian.
Sure, but non-Irish, right?
Yeah.
Big Hollywood star. And then also that film features Patrick Bergen, who we just covered in Sleeping with the Enemy, and yet another cliche Irish character actor. Instead of Brenda Fricker, we get, not the mother, but the father, Pete Postlethwaite.
He's not Irish.
You're positive?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, he's Giuseppe Conlon in The Name of the Father.
That was set in Liverpool, though, wasn't it?
Well, among Irish characters.
British, hang on one second. British, he's English.
Okay.
Yeah, he was born, he's from Lancashire.
Sorry, fact checking. I'm glad we're not expounding fake news here. Anyway, we have two films that claim to tell the story of Veronica Guerin. This was the one that is clearly the more high profile, with this kind of major Hollywood team behind it.
Yeah.
Do you find it odd, Sean, that this movie somehow attracted the interest of Bruckheimer and Schumacher?
Okay, I kind of find it piquing the interest of American filmmakers in the same way The Departed would.
Well, and in fact, the musical score owes a lot to The Departed.
Well, The Departed came after this
film. I know it did, but I mean, it's in the same vein, isn't it?
Well, today is today, darling. Don't worry, you have the power of edit.
Yeah, but it's in the same vein, isn't it?
Yeah, it's in the same vein. I thought we were always 1 minute away from the Dropkick Murphys being played. But this is the thing, it's like, the way that Boston is actually just an American city, but it's also not, it's a hotbed of Irish criminality, depending on how you want to look at it. It's like a Irish mafia kind of story. Probably this was the same starting point for these American filmmakers to get on board. But to be honest, their kind of American sensibilities of action movie blockbuster making does not sit well with this story, or the pace, or the characters, or the reality of it. Ireland is a small country. All politics are local politics. Even national issues are still local issues. And I just find, like, with the pomp and ceremony and grandeur and, you know, va-va-voom, as it were, by these American guys, it just doesn't feel right. It feels really weird. It's a weird film.
It's a really weird film that kind of, like, feels like it sometimes is doing what you've just described, and sometimes is just almost like a TV movie made with sort of like low budget grit, like a kind of extended episode of Law and Order SVU Dublin Edition.
Well, you know what? It would have been really good as a TV miniseries. Well, maybe now, perhaps.
Yeah, but this is before the era of kind of prestige television, right? Like, I actually think in terms of a Joel Schumacher movie, frankly, it's a bit restrained in that regard. It has Cate Blanchett in the lead and not, like, I don't know, Nicolas Cage. And, like, neither Jerry Bruckheimer nor Joel Schumacher, as far as I can tell, like, based on their names, are Irish people with Irish roots. So, like, it's really unclear to me, like, who they thought the audience was, or what the point of entry for them was with this
movie.
And
the fact they're both there, you know? Not just one of them.
Yeah.
It's so weird.
It's really weird. Maybe, you know, he was talking to Chris O'Donnell during the making of Batman and Robin, and somehow, you know, it morphed into this project.
But I think Joel Schumacher did that film Photo Booth, or Phone Booth, with Colin Farrell.
He did.
So, I think Colin Farrell does have a cameo in this film.
Colin Farrell is one of the most life-giving aspects of this film. When he pops up, it's kind of like, you're like, oh my god, like, this person is going to go on to become a major person. Even though he's just basically a nameless, hot, hunky thug on the street.
Yeah, he's gorgeous, isn't he? He plays a character called Tattooed Boy.
He's got, like, a tattoo of a spider web on his neck and, like, a shaved head. And you can tell Cate Blanchett is like, this guy's going to be big, and I don't just mean his career. You know, that's what she's thinking when she has her brief dialogue with him.
In a weird meta moment for us, Colin Farrell is watching Eric Cantona, like, score a goal or something. I don't know. He says, this fella here plays for a team, Man United.
What's the score?
Nothing. Cantona's a fucking vacuum cleaner today, man. It's unreal. He's what you call a striker. Number 7, watch him.
A striker? What did you say his name was?
Eric Cantona.
Born 26th of May 1966, led Man United to 6 Cups, winning Premier League Football of the Year in 89. Is that him?
Well, fuck me, Pink. I think it is. Yeah. Fair play to you.
I met him, you know.
You met Eric Cantona?
Yeah.
What did he say to you?
It doesn't matter, does it? She's a genius.
He is a fucking genius, man. It's deadly.
So it's supposed to be like the fact that she's actually a football fan and she's not just some woman, you know,
Some slag.
She knows an awful lot. And then she goes, you know, I met him. And the funny thing is, like, this is Veronica talking, but actually, we're looking at as Kate talking to Colin Farrell, the actor, as an actor, about Eric Cantona, the actor.
Like the movie we just saw.
Yeah,
the
Elizabeth,
before.
Which is so, that is so weird.
Yeah, I met him and he was wearing an Elizabethan ruff. Okay, so you've zeroed in on one aspect of the way they present Veronica Guerin. So, first of all, literally, I don't know why they never cast Cate Blanchett as Princess Diana, because, like, she has the exact same hairdo.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
There's one scene toward the end where she frustratingly kicks a football against a wall a little bit, wrings her hands and gnashes her teeth. I want to find out how you can make, like, GIFs, because I want to just take that scene and be like, like, lost footage of Diana has been rediscovered trying to play football or something.
It's really weird. Like, do you think Kate looks believably like an Irish woman? She's still got that kind of, like, ruddy face youth that, like, she had.
Why do you keep using this word ruddy for Irish people?
Because you're pale people who have ruddy cheeks when you're out in the cold and you know, get hot and bothered.
We drink a lot and go red face, isn't it?
You said it, not me. But she still has that kind of, like, rosy-cheeked Irish lass kind of thing going on. And, well, she's still quite young when she made this film.
If she's Australian, there's a high chance that she has some Irish criminals in her family history.
That's all too true. They want to paint Veronica, like, at the beginning, she's this cheeky lass who, you know, likes trying to get out of her parking tickets and her speeding tickets. She loves football. She's sort of one of the lads. She's also just kind of bullshy, and she sort of walks up to people, and whether they're gangsters or politicians or cops, she kind of says what's on her mind.
Yeah.
So this movie, I feel like, falls into that subcategory of relatively pedestrian, hagiographic films that actresses take on, you know, like Erin Brockovich being the gold standard of this type of film, which is like the whole movie exists to kind of be like this woman against the world, taking on the system. Everybody doubts that she's actually the one who has the moxie to be able to do what she does. And Erin Brockovich doesn't get whacked by the you know,
PG&E.
Yeah, by the company that's polluting the water. Veronica Guerin does, but her legacy lives on. Do you think that, like, the character of Veronica Guerin, as conceived in this film and as played by Kate, has any kind of roundedness or three dimension to it? Or is it just standard woman going up against the boys?
No one really knew who Erin Brockovich was in America. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
Yeah, so she wasn't, like, a national figure. Also, Erin Brockovich was a struggling mother trying to hold down a job first before she became an investigative campaigner, whatever she, activist.
Paralegal,
okay? That film has a lot going for it in terms of character development, you know, roundedness. So in this film, for instance, the problem is that Veronica Guerin was known as investigative. She didn't really have this, like, human side that everybody knew. She wasn't. Her family life is in the film, but it's not really part of who she is. She's driven by this goal to find out the truth and to bring justice to people who deserve getting justice and getting their arses kicked off to prison. The film is so, in many ways, so frantic, okay? There's a scene at the very start of it that kind of encapsulates the whole thing. And it's so typical in this kind of film, where she comes home, so everybody's at home, first of all.
She's Irish, so there's lots of people. Everyone's had oodles of children. No birth control.
Stop it. It's not just her husband and her son. It's
Uncle, whoever, and what's
her name?
And Brenda Frickerson.
And all their children, and Brenda Fricker. And she comes in, you can tell, she's one of those women who comes in, immediately takes off the suit jacket. I bet, like, my mother, My mother would come home, take off her suit from work and put on like some top, you know?
It's actually a football jersey.
Yeah, it's a football jersey. She comes out like racing a mile a minute, kisses everybody, tastes the soup, then runs out and plays football with all the children. And it's just like, this is too fast. Everything is going too fast.
Well, it's because they want to paint the fact that, yes, she's a career woman and she's driven by her interest in this story, but she also has a family. I mean, the depiction of her husband, he's this, like, doormat, yeah, you know, Dawn Gummer, Andrew Upton type, who's just there mildly being like, you've received, like, 4 death threats, Veronica. Like, maybe we ought to stop this here now because our children are about to be kidnapped. And she used to, like, I've got to get this story.
Exactly. Veronica Guerin is the story of a pioneering woman who just wouldn't take a rest.
There is one scene early on, it's probably the first scene after the 2 years earlier title cards, where she shows up at this, is it the north side of Dublin housing estates?
Yeah, one of the flats.
And she's kind of wandering around. I mean, I'm sure
the heroin-ridden estates probably did look that bad.
The extras, the young people who play the junkies, literally look ghoulish. Their faces have become blackened by drug use. There are small children, like, literally playing with discarded needles. There's, like, old ladies peeking through lace curtains, like, worried that they're gonna get whacked. And there's, like, you know, thuggish-looking men just, like, wandering around and cursing. And there's Veronica, like, strolling through. So, like, that scene is really the only motivation that we get. It's a horrific scene, and it looks hellish. And she's obviously been an investigative reporter, so she has contacts and sources within the underworld, most notably Kieran Hines, who plays some guy called the Coach, who's like a small-time brothel owner and is kind of connected to all the criminal overlords.
Yeah, who likes getting his name in the papers.
Yeah, and she kind of has this ongoing relationship with him. He keeps feeding her information. But what I'm saying is, like, we are meant to believe, and I'm sure it's true, it's probably based on fact, that this woman is so driven to solve this case that she will survive. Literally, I mean, she gets shot in the leg, she gets her children threatened, she gets beaten up at one point,
yeah,
and every single point that you think, okay, maybe this woman is gonna stop, she just goes right back to the story because she's so hungry to solve it.
Well, you know what, though? I did a little bit of research about Veronica Guerin's life before we did this. And it turns out she just seems to be one of those young women who just was there doing everything. She was on, like, the athletics team. She went to Trinity, did accounting. She like, ran a PR firm. And she would have been, like, 23 doing all this.
There's these sort of scenes of the kind of chattering classes elite of the Irish media scene who are kind of looking down their noses at her, saying she actually hasn't studied journalism. She's known for these splashy investigative stories. In a rag. Which paper is it?
Sunday Independent, absolute rag.
Yeah, why don't you come in and have a pint? Too many journalists for me.
You can't join the club if you ignore the members, Veronica.
I know what they say about me. No journalistic experience. I'm exaggerating the drug problem. My sources are unreliable. Can't spell.
Pretty accurate.
Go away, child, Willie. I know I'm no great writer. Well, I think you're a poet, Veronica.
And again, this is the kind of Erin Brockovich type of it, right? Is that she's not the ace accomplished reporter. She's not necessarily the person you would expect to be going about this in the right possible way. I guess my question is, like, do you think the way they portray Veronica, yes, she's sympathetic because she wants to solve this case, but she's also putting herself and her family at grave risk. Like, do they present her as actually someone who's a bit foolhardy?
I mean, I'm not an investigative reporter, but,
oh,
if
really?
if I were, I think I would be a little bit more of a shrinking violet.
Well, yeah, because there's a moment where, after she's been threatened the very first time, she does these, like, television specials where she's being interviewed, and then her face is, like, literally on the side of a bus, and you're like, surely if you want to be an investigative reporter, you want to keep a slightly low profile, not to the degree where everywhere you walk in, they're like, here comes Saint Veronica, oh, we know who this person is. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
How are you expected to, like, actually solve this if your face is the major part of the story?
Well, I guess that wasn't her decision to be on the side of buses, but it was her decision to kind of use the technique that she does. But I think this is part of her appeal, both when she was a journalist And as a person, I'm going to cut through the bullshit. I'm going to ask. I'm going to not put up with any phony answers. And I'm going to publish it. That just seems to be her mode for doing things. And I kind of believe it.
I don't think we need to go blow by blow through all of the plot lines. There's kind
no,
of,
it's too complicated, really.
I mean, it is and it isn't. It's like she gets false leads that this one is actually the drug dealer, and it's actually another one, and they all have names like the monk and the coach and the general and all these kind of...
There was a film, another film, a couple of years previously, directed by John Borman, which is about this guy, the general, who is in Veronica Guerin, but albeit in a much smaller capacity. But this film was entirely about him, and it starred Brendan Gleeson and John Voight. And John Borman won Best Director at Cannes that year.
Well, it sounds like it's a bit of more of an accomplished piece of cinema.
Well, it's
than
in
this.
Black and white. So.
Oh, in black and white. The two kind of main things that I want to talk about for the remainder of the film are the masculine presence and the maternal presence.
Okay.
So can we talk about the men, the gangsters? So she kind of moves within this world. We've already talked about Kieran Hines, but the main kind of mob boss. There's one actually called Tony Mullen, a distant relation of mine. I was glad that he wasn't called Fatso Mullen, because there was somebody else there called Fatso Mitchell.
That would be triggering, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it really would. But the main guy is this guy called Gilligan.
Yeah, John now, Gilligan.
Who is the actor?
Jordan McSorley.
I mean, I thought he was perfectly cast. We have a lot of colorful, different kind of minor gangsters, including one really fit one who happens to be named Brian, who gets strip searched at one point and has nice lean
muscles.
Yeah,
he's really bad. He's the one who fucking kills her.
That's fine. He was hot. Like, he's going to get put away in prison and he's going to make some other prisoners really happy. That's all I'm going to say about that. The main guy actually keeps a relatively low profile, and he and his wife
are
the most sinister
villains
in any movie ever. Now, so what is the business enterprise that they use as a kind of cover for all the drug money that they're laundering?
It's a stud farm, and you can tell that these are people with absolutely no class who are trying to get involved in a very esteemed profession.
Did you want to just explain what a stud farm is to our mostly gay listeners who are probably thinking something entirely other?
They're thinking, oh my god, how can I get to one of them? A stud farm. So when a horse goes to stud, that means that the male horse is there to breed with the female horses. And quite often, very successful race horses, as when they retire, that's kind of their, you know, reward.
What a life.
As it were. Mm. Just to impregnate fillies all day long.
Goodness. So the place is actually seems like it's the baby of his wife, who I have to admit, I don't know who that actress was playing Gilligan's wife. She is the absolutely most amazing Irish character actor
epitomizes evil
I've ever seen. So, I mean, she's brilliant. Like, I think the first time she comes in, one of the other gangsters, like, set off a gun or something, and she comes in saying, you know, which of you feckin' Egypts has been disturbing my horses? Or I'm sure you could do it better.
Man, nice attempt, Brian, but it's more like...
I'm really trying to not embarrass myself here.
That was pretty low embarrassment, to be fair.
Thanks.
But she says things more like, which of you fucking bastards is playing with a fucking gun around my horses, you bastards?
Can you also say the following line for me? So there's another point where she's trying to act all high class, and there's some, like, investors or other breeders coming by, and she's offering them an aperitif. Do you remember this line?
She says, should we have some caviar or champers? It's all imported.
Champers. So you think she's kind of comic relief until the moment where...
so evil.
Oh my god, this is so awful.
She has two evil moments in particular.
Yeah. Well, Veronica has sort of finally moved her way to the top of the criminal pyramid to go. So she, again, in a foolhardy manner, by herself, in a car, drives up to this...
his front door, basically.
...stud farm and doorsteps him and starts, you know, asking him direct questions about where he gets his money from, and is it all from drug dealing? And, I mean, this was one of the most shocking and horrific moments in the entire film. Do you want to describe what happens?
So she asks him, you know, I'm Veronica Guerin, where do you get your money from?
And she makes this kind of smug expression with her eyebrows.
He pauses for a moment, and then he punches her repeatedly, calling her a see-you-next-Tuesday over and over again.
Repeatedly, she is bloodied.
Yeah, it's pretty graphic.
Then he pushes her into her car and says, "Are you wearing a wire?" and starts ripping her clothes.
Yeah, it's very, very, very intense.
It's really, really disturbing. Meanwhile, in the background, the aforementioned wife...
She comes and she stands at the door with, like, a gin and tonic in her hand and sips it, smirking while this happens, you know, just doing nothing but enjoying it.
It's truly, truly awful. I can only assume it's based on an actual incident.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
It's horrible. And then, of course, Veronica, Saint Veronica the Martyr, goes on television showing her bruises, and the whole issue is whether she's going to press charges against this guy or not. Now, all through this movie, Sean, as Veronica is making all these choices, we kept thinking to ourselves, when is Brenda Fricker going to get a scene?
Yeah, where's her Oscar clip?
Okay, so before we get to what mildly passes as Brenda Fricker's Oscar clip, I have to ask you a question. Like, is Brenda Fricker kind of a joke to Irish people?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Like, I mean, my best friend fears that she's going to end up looking like Brenda Fricker.
Because, I mean, like, I have an enormous amount of goodwill to Brenda Fricker. Like, do you know when they do those Oscars family albums, which they haven't done for a while, like, probably because the logistics of it are so terrible.
And it'll be 4.5 hours long. Yeah,
they bring out, like, some bleachers, and they have all these Oscar winners sit on it. I can only assume that if you've won an acting Oscar, you get an automatic invite to those things, because it's like Red Buttons and, like, George Chakiris.
Faye Dunaway, Network. Robert Duvall, Tender Mercies. Louise Fletcher, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
But I always, my heart, like, fills with joy when I see
Brenda Fricker, My Left Foot.
You know, next to whoever else begin Lou Gossett Jr. from F to G. I don't know who it is. But it's like, okay, here she is, just looking like an Irish mammy and an Academy Award winner. It's really wonderful. The problem is that having won her Oscar for My Left Foot, I don't really know if anyone else has ever found the occasion to use her properly. They just keep casting her as mothers and cooks servants.
She was very good in Home Alone 2.
Who was she in Home Alone 2?
She was the bird woman.
Okay. Feed the birds.
No, she was the scary bird woman.
Wait, so she and Donald Trump have appeared in a movie together?
Yes.
Talk about scary bird people.
Yeah.
But, like, it's literally, like, there are so many times where I'm like, Brenda Fricker deserves better than this. Like, that terrible movie Cloudburst, honestly, if you're ever looking for a really execrable LGBT film to program in a bad film festival, this movie... It basically is Olympia Dukakis and Brenda Fricker as, like, an aging lesbian couple who are trying to escape from Maine to Canada, and Brenda Fricker is blind, and at one point she's, like, running blind through a field and, like, falling down into, like, mud and stuff, and you're just like, Brenda, you deserve better than this. Or even more undignified, we were watching Albert Nobbs one time.
We actually never finished Albert Nobbs.
Well, we're watching it, and we're literally like, wait a minute, why does the cook in the hotel in Albert Nobbs, who has no lines, look so familiar? Oh my god, it's Brenda Fricker! Okay, so in Veronica Guerin, cliche alert, she plays a long-suffering mother, and here she is, and it's just like scenes of, like, Brenda folding laundry, Brenda on the side of a room while Kate Blanchett, like, walks through. Kate says things like, where are those candles for the birthday cake? She's like, on top of the bread box. And you're just like, Is she ever going to get a scene where she, like, talks to her daughter?
I think this is the thing, is, like, she does get the most minute scenes where she's like, look at this now. It's a photo of you. Sure, you always wanted to be better than the boys, didn't you?
That's her big scene.
That's it. That's basically it.
She tells a story about how Veronica loved football as a kid and kicked the ball over the fence into the scary yard of old man Clancy, let it be known.
Also a relative of yours.
A relative of mine, my grandmother's...
I believe he was called Fat Old Man Clancy.
My grandmother's family are the Clancys. The Clancys of Cork. Anyway, but that's her, like, big scene is, like, you know, sometimes, Veronica, it's better to just let the crazy old man hang on to the ball and not go and get it back. And, of course, this is major foreshadowing and foreboding because it is a scene that comes soon before Veronica ends up, you know, dying in the pursuit of her cause.
Well, she was a very admirable woman, and she is kind of a legend, and actually...
Brenda.
Veronica.
I thought we were talking about Brenda. Is she kind of a legend?
No, she is also kind of a legend.
Okay.
Yeah, back to Veronica for a second. You know, her son is a year younger than me. He's out in Dubai at the moment, managing an Irish pub in Dubai.
Sean, there but for the grace of God go you.
Exactly. He's quite beefy as well. He is ruddy-faced. He's actually quite cute. Now, should I tell my story?
Yes, I just want to say one last thing. Like, basically, the whole thing has this circular structure. Veronica, who we know passed away at the beginning of the film, we watched the whole circumstances.
She didn't pass away, darling, she was killed.
Well, yeah, so we get the whole circumstances of how she's been killed, and it is, again, still very gruesome. We have this, like, horrific close-up of Kate Blanchett's face, and then there's kind of about 5 or 7 minutes of essentially slow-mo of everybody kind of like learning the facts. And
can I just say,
the musical score here really troubled you.
But this is where an American director, an American producer, really just do not know how to deal with Irish mourning.
The screenplay was written by two Irish women.
Yeah, but they chose to do it this way. Come on.
The screenwriters.
No. This is all to do with the director and the producer as well, you know.
Okay, tell us.
Basically, everyone finds out in slow motion.
Wordlessly.
In slow motion, that Veronica has died. Actually, it's so slow motion that nobody cries or shouts or wails or really has time to react. And mostly they're just turning from side to side very slowly. And it's tragedy. It's absolute tragedy, we should say. But an even more egregious tragedy is that legendary Irish, you know, folk song, I suppose you could say, The Fields of Athenry, is sung over this.
By
a child. And the I swear to God, Brian, the child sounds like it's being put through a vocoder, like the Cher effect. Watch the small free birds fly. Our love was on the wing. We had dreams and songs to sing. It's so lonely around the fields of Athenry. It is horrendous. It is an absolute assault on my ears.
The slow motion goes over such a long time that I believe actually the song ends. And the movie's still going on, and then some other song plays. Like, and then the thing that really bothered me is, okay, so we've had these really clunky title cards at the beginning explaining, like, what the heroin scene in 1996 Dublin was like. Instead of title cards, we now get a voiceover of a male voice going on at great length to say things like, 1 week after Veronica's death, the Constitution of the Republic of Ireland was changed to create the Criminal Assets Bureau and all this stuff. And I'm just literally like, who is speaking?
Yeah.
Like, is this a character? Is this the, you know, member of parliament that Veronica was allied with? Is this one of the cops? Is this her husband? Nope. It's just a nameless announcer voice who is there to kind of reassure us that, like, Veronica's sacrifice and her work resulted in, like, legislative accomplishments and the ultimate conviction of all these gangsters. And then the movie just kind of fades out after this, like, long description of, like, what's happened to each of the bad guys.
Well, the thing is, like, because there's obviously were title cards at the beginning and a voiceover at the end, that just shows you that something is heavily missing from the story. That enough context for us to come in cold without having to get all of this. I mean, I actually love a title card at the start of a film, because that throws you immediately into the action.
Yeah, but it's got to be, like, an evocative title card, not one that's, like, overwritten to just kind of tell you some facts. We actually had quite a lot of title cards in Elizabeth as well, giving us, like, updates on, you know, the Protestants versus the Catholics. The last title card does say, everyone remembers where they were when Veronica died. So, Sean, I don't think you actually did remember, but you immediately WhatsApped your mother.
Yeah, I asked my mother. There's no hello. It's just, do you remember where you were when Veronica Guerin died? And she texted back and said, yes, We were in Santa Ponsa in Mallorca on our first family holiday internationally. My father had rung Ireland off a payphone and had been told that Veronica Guerin had died that night. So that means I was also in Santa Ponsa in Spain, as was my sister and my mother. And then I was like, all right, that's it. And then the conversation ended, okay? And my mother, I could just see typing, you know, the WhatsApp message, typing. I was like, oh no, what's coming next? And then she replied saying, it was also the night that you told me that you didn't have to be married to have children. And I was like, oh my God, did I really say that? She clarified it again by saying, actually, it was when you asked me if I knew that you didn't have to be married to have children because of a girl that I'd been playing with that day called Jade. That
playing with a girl called Jade. Things never change.
That
had
told me that that you didn't have to be married to have children. And it's so funny, you know, when something significant does happen in the world, you remember certain other things that happened that same day. The day of the September 11th attacks, we also got our very first cordless phone.
Well, there you go, and these things will be forever linked. You and your discovery of adulterous sexuality and, you know, the nation-changing death of a famous investigative journalist.
Exactly.
Forever linked. I will say one thing, because we've kind of not really talked about Kate Blanchett fully. She kind of emerges from this film unscathed.
Oh, completely
right?
Unscathed,
like,
yeah.
The film itself is pedestrian and a disappointment in terms of possibly what it could have been. It's no Spotlight, right?
No, not at all, even a little bit.
But, like, there is one scene that kind of shows us, I think, a glimmer of the sort of three-dimensionality that they're trying to go for Veronica. She's gotten a really horrific phone threat from Gilligan where he says something like, I'm going to come to your house, kidnap your boy, ride him, and kill you. And then he says that about three times.
Basically.
And I was like, because I've known you to use ride.
Because ride is like just shag, but like...
Yeah, but I was like, does he really mean he's going to rape her son?
Yes.
It's pretty awful. And so she then, having heard this from him over the phone line, gets up and goes to the toilet and vomits and then starts crying and her husband has to comfort her. So, but I think what's interesting is that as she's doing this, she says to her husband, whatever you do, don't tell anyone that I was like this. Even though I'm feeling vulnerable and afraid right now, I don't want anyone to ever know that I was afraid. So, you know, this is like her, like, moment of deepest despair where she's kind of hit rock bottom and she kind of pulls herself together. So it is yet again that Cate Blanchett trope that we talked about in Elizabeth of, like, private moments of vulnerability where she then has to put her armor on again, put her performance on, whether it's Veronica Guerin or Elizabeth, and go out to face the world. So maybe this is the Cate Blanchett thing, is like a woman who kind of artificially presents herself, you know, and then we watch as that sort of breaks down in these kind of key moments of humanity.
Well, manifesto, darling. Manifesto.
Manifesto indeed. All right, so I kind of didn't hate Veronica Guerin.
No, I didn't hate it either. It's a good example of a bad film that could have been something entirely different.
Everyone in the Republic of Ireland remembers where they were when they heard that Veronica Guerin had been murdered on the Naas Road.
Yeah, I mean, of all the bad films we've watched, there have been a lot worse ones than Veronica Guerin. And I learned a lot, Sean.
You learned a lot, yeah.
Mostly from you.
Well, it's nice for you to experience my culture sometimes. I know you come from the most dominant culture in the world.
Elizabethan England.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's good to find out about a small, vaguely insignificant island off the west coast of the Atlantic, Ireland.
Erin Go Bragh. All right, so we have one more Cate Blanchett film that we are going to cover. It is a truly crazy one. I'm sure that Sean is bursting at his Irish seams to talk about it.
Can't wait.
Yeah. We will crack open a Guinness while you log on to our Twitter, at Broad Appeal Pod, and have a look at the tease of what that film is going to be.
And if you want to follow us individually, I'm at Sean McGovern X and Brian's at BA Mullen Speaks.
Cate Blanchett will have a completely other accent in our next episode, and we hope you enjoy it.
Bye.